Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Augustin Macellari.
On today's show, we'll be meeting art curator Claire Lilly, who's overseeing Free Sculpture, London's three-month showcase of outdoor creativity taking place in Regent's Park from this week onwards.
Then we'll be hearing from musician Marcus Miller. The bass player and band leader will be discussing his new album, Laid Black, and discussing some of the hits he's played on. Artists ranging from Miles Davis to Luther Vandross.
And we'll be meeting Oliver Wainwright, the architecture critic whose new book, Inside North Korea, looks at the unusual design in the isolated nation. Or the stuff the outside world's allowed to see, anyway.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco has designs on next week's news. And we'll enjoy some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Org, what a week it's been. London still bathed in sunshine.
Glorious sunshine, exactly right.
Well, this brings us just so elegantly onto a man who will never fail to have his shorts on when the sun's out. Let's bring him in. It's Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando.
Fernando, welcome. Your theme music plays. The sun is shining.
And shorts are being discussed.
It's a happy time.
Yes.
2013. Shorts wear of the year.
2013.
Well, look, whilst the sun continues to shine, do you have news rays of sunshine for the week ahead to share with us?
A very interesting week, and one that I'm very curious to see how the public here in the UK will react. On Thursday the 12th, Donald Trump will finally have a state visit here in the UK. I think it's been discussed in the press for the last year because people are saying, I mean, should he really come or not? In my opinion, I think he should, and I think people should protest if they want to. And he will be indeed meeting the Queen. He'll meet Theresa May. I think he wants to avoid London with good reasons, because I do think the protests will be quite large.
Will you be waving a Stars and Stripes org or protesting? Or neither of the
above? I believe I'll be at work, Tom, but I am.
It's all right. You are allowed to express yourself politically here in Midori House org if you want to.
Are you sure?
Yeah, within reason.
I'm put in mind of, I think it was a 2015 motion by the sort of Houses of Parliament, wasn't there, to denounce Trump as a kind of racist and a bad candidate. And in an unusual act of prescience, David Cameron vetoed it on the basis that maybe one day we were going to have to negotiate with him as a world leader. And he was laughed out of the room. And here we are, David Cameron, for once, probably, I say for once, he's always feeling smug.
A smug man, and he's still being, well, he's not really even being laughed at now, he's being derided, I guess that's...
Danny Dyer, last week.
A little bit different.
Did you see that?
I didn't, Org. For our international listeners, get on the old Google machine, that'll help you with that one. Fernando, so Trump's visit, that's food for thought. What next?
Something perhaps a bit more fun is my next item, which will start on Friday the 13th. I know we're all excited about the World Cup and, the final. It's happening on the 15th of July, but this time there's another football championship. It's the Swamp Soccer World Championship in Finland.
Swamp Soccer?
Yes.
And tell us more, Fernando.
It's been very traditional in Finland since the year of 2000. But guys, I thought, okay, we're just going to be 10 teams and a couple of hundred people. But no. I mean, this kind of championship attracts 300 teams from all over the world, not only Finland. So more than 4,000 players. So yes, basically there's a very muddy field. There's about 20 of them in this area in Finland. And I saw some trailers. I have to say, even though I am a bit of a city, so probably I usually don't like to be in the mud, but it sounds very fun. And the exercise you do, because the whole thing started with, cross-country skiers in Finland. They wanted to get fit. So I think they found a muddy field and they start playing football. It's very hard and a bit slower as well.
Well, this is it. Apparently, it's like running on a sandy beach. It's very good for your muscles because you sink away and you don't get... Of course, it's much better than running on a uniform flat surface anyway.
I think Monaco should organise a
swamp football team.
For next year, we should head to Finland.
What's the entry criteria?
To be honest, you just have to pay the fee and I think you're in.
quite
I think that's the entry. So
this could be the only sporting tournament that a Midori House 11 could get into.
Where do you go? Captain, self-nominated?
I'd give it a bash. The only thing is I'm scared off of going to Finland because of Marcus Hippie, our colleague's insistence on full nude sauna.
Oh, yeah.
I think direct from the airport. As I understand it, it's a national requirement.
And please don't be naked when you're playing this in the mud. You know, you better not.
What do they wear?
Well, they wear like old gym wear in a way.
Okay, so that is kits. They're not just in shorts or...
No. I think you can basically choose what you want, as long as you pay the fee.
Fernando, always good to speak to you. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be hearing from Claire Lilly, talking about a summer of wonderful free art just around the corner from here at Midori House in London's Regent's Park. The Frieze Art Fair is an essential, if fleeting, highlight on London's art calendar. But prior to that, Regent's Park also hosts Frieze Sculpture, a free showcase of some of the world's most forward-thinking visual art. It kicks off this week and is on show for 3 months throughout the summer.
Visitors can see works from 25 artists from five different continents, including John Baldessari, Rachel Feinstein, James Capper, Tracy Emin and more. Joining us today to talk through it is curator Claire Lilly, who's also director of programme at Yorkshire Sculpture Park.
Welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Claire. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. And always an exciting time of year. And amazingly, London has been blessed with proper go and visit the sculpture in Regent's Park weather this week, for which we should all be very grateful. Tell me a bit about the project. Is this something that is just a joy to do? Is the sort of legwork incredibly challenging? Well, you know, the first week when everything gets going, is it just relief? Is it delight? What's the sort of emotional mix?
For me, the whole process is delight because I don't have to fundraise for this show. I don't have to do any of the logistics. I don't have to organise anything. I'm really asked by Frieze to look at a number of artists' proposals and then to decide on what we're going to show, and also to have conversations with artists and their galleries to encourage proposals. So I guess for this exhibition, we've had something like 70 proposals and I've honed it down to 25. And actually, that's a lot. This is the largest free sculpture we've made so far.
You mentioned the kind of logistical difficulties and avoiding them. I know that last year there was sort of mind-blowing tonnage of earth being shifted to kind of lay foundations for these gigantic sculptures. It kind of operates on a similar scale this year, does it?
Well, with slightly less tonnage in soil because of the nature of the works, but actually some works which are still larger than we had last year. But to bring in, 25 artists, but it's actually around 38 individual sculptures. And to site those over 6 days is kind of no mean feat. That's a lot of gear. So we've had 2-3 cranes on site. We've had high abs, which are the cranes on the backs of long, low loaders. It's actually fascinating. I love it. I love this whole process of siting sculpture and seeing the way that sculpture is moved. Of course, I'm not the one doing it. We have a company called MTech who've been overseeing everything in the park, and they're absolutely brilliant guys to work with.
Well, I wanted to ask you a bit about that side of the curatorial process, I guess, and the decision making. You mentioned whittling the pieces down. How different is it? I mean, obviously, by definition, you have this time frame. It's open through till the early October, is that right?
That's right, October 7th.
So you have things like the changing seasons of London, all the rest of it. What are the kind of key factors that have informed your decision making in that process?
Well, the area that we're talking about, which is the southeast corner of Regent's Park, is the English Gardens, which was designed by Markham Nesfield in 1866. It's a really very beautiful landscape, an extremely good collection of trees. And it's traversed by a number of pathways. And of course, the pathways in a way form the framework for how I think about the exhibition. But I'm also very aware of the kind of journeys that people take through that piece of land. Mm. And I've been there at all times of the year and with and without sculpture there. So I have a pretty good understanding of how the place is used. And I know that there are points of emphasis that I really need to pull out. And they're points which have a kind of a drama about them, which pull people into that space. And I guess once I have those spectacular moments, I know that I can grab attention. And there are really three of those. And then there are two areas which are really quite big and they need something that's bold and has got guts. So those come next. And that forms my skeleton. And then around that, I make what I hope are kind of lyrical moments, funny moments, engaging moments. So it's a kind of process of infilling. I'm really working with the geography of the park, but also the terrain. So I'm looking at these intimate spaces which are framed by trees. I know the trees really well, so I know how they're going to change over time. So at the moment, I have got a piece by Barty Kerr, which is 4.5 metres high. And for me, it was just really important that this piece was set against an incredible copper beach. And so it's framed by the copper beach. Of course, that will change by October. There will be a change in the tree, but still, it forms a really important foil to that work. So, you know, this is what I do. I do sculpture outdoors. I do sculpture in kind of park areas where I work in Yorkshire. We have a 500-acre landscape. And all the time you're learning about the landscape. And for me, it's really very much a melding of landscape, the natural world, such as it is, within a park, and sculpture.
I'm interested in the in kind of reflecting on your day job. Obviously, you've got visitors at Yorkshire Sculpture Park who are kind of a captive art audience. They're there to come and see sculptures in landscape. Regent's Park, you might have joggers, picnickers, tourists, whomever it may be. How does that affect the kind of decision-making behind how you choose the work and how you come to install it?
It definitely has an impact. Although, actually, I don't think the audiences are so dramatically different between here and Yorkshire, but that's a kind of another subject. When I'm selecting work, of course, I'm really aware of collectors who are going to come between now and October, but particularly during Frieze Week. And the work that they're interested in, work which has resonance in the art world today. And I know a number of the collectors who are likely to look at the work, the type of work that we're showing in Frieze Sculpture. But the majority of the people who see this exhibition are people who probably have absolutely no notion about contemporary art and are, as you say, jogging or live in the... I mean, a lot of people use Regent's Park. I think they have something like 6 million people use Regent's Park every year. I don't know what proportion of those people go through the English Gardens, but it's an awful lot of people. And so I'm very aware that some of the works that we show have to have a very immediate appeal, and that, you know, they're funny, they can be colourful, they can be spectacular, delightful. But in any case, and of course, nobody who goes into Frieze Sculpture is going to like absolutely everything they see. But what I hope is that there is enough variety, and the variety is amazing this year, and there are enough kind of touchstones for people to have that contact and to access the exhibition in a way that is kind of fruitful and enjoyable for people.
I think that sort of accessibility question is great. And I suppose that serendipitous moment where someone who's unaware of it wanders through and is like, wow, what is happening here? That must be hugely exciting. Do you ever sort of wander through and spy on people who are doing that to see the moment of delight and discovery? It must be quite fun.
It's wonderful. And gosh, how many people this week? I mean, there are also people now who recognise me because there are people who use that park every single day. A guy came jogging up to me the other day. He said, oh, it's great. It's fantastic to have Frieze Sculpture back. And how much they enjoy it, and they bring their children, and then they'll bring their cousins, and
kids love stuff like this. You know, it's that weird thing, it's almost out of place and yet it's of the place, and there's a serendipity about that must be fun. But do you have to almost keep, because kids want to scale everything, don't they, and climb up it? But is that kind of good? Do you like that tactility?
We have to be pretty careful with the whole kind of tactility business, but you know, the great thing about young children is they just don't have barriers. You know, they're not coming with any kind of preset ideas. But sculpture outdoors does do things that other art doesn't do, particularly when it's kind of curated into a body of work in the way that this is, rather than simply a standalone sculpture. One of the works that we have in the exhibition is by Tracy Emin, and essentially they are 5 bronze birds atop 4 metre high, very slender poles. And she made the first kind of iteration of that work for the public realm in Hong Kong. And she said, you know, I'm very aware that loads of people really hate public sculpture. They really can't stand it. And, you know, they see it as a kind of something that you bump into as you're trying to make your way through a city. And one of the reasons, of course, she's been working with birds for a long time, but she said, you know, no one can hate a bird. And it's true. And they do kind of look like little missives of love or wonder on top of these poles. And, you know, she's somebody who really understands how to communicate with people. That's the essence of her work. And I've watched that happen. I've watched conversations happen over the last week that just wouldn't have happened otherwise.
To go back to the connection it shares with the Frieze Art Fair, you know, which is this enormous kind of showcase of the world's galleries in Regent's Park, can you talk a bit about how this sort of sculptural installation, which is, as you say, like loaded with serendipity, a kind of beautiful way of enhancing this garden, how does it sort of operate in the context of this commercial art fair?
I wouldn't really say that it's a snapshot of contemporary sculpture. It's certainly a platform for sculpture made for outdoors. And, you know, there is a market for that. And there are people around the world who will seek it out for that very reason, who are commissioning work for their own gardens, parklands. You know, there are many people around the world building outdoor sculpture collections. And of course, there are museums as well who do exactly the same thing. So it very definitely works alongside the fair and alongside Masters. I think has, you know, a real resonance for a particular type of collector who has a very particular kind of set of circumstances that they want to deal with.
Claire, just to pick up on that point, we're talking a little bit about the public discourse around public sculpture. And obviously, there's a lot of talk always in London about public statuary or whatever you want to call it. Do you feel that your day-to-day work, and particularly this showcase and your involvement with it, do you feel any sense of responsibility to be contributing to that wider debate, particularly for London, where it's quite divisive? People, as you said, consider it, you know, a waste of money. We shouldn't have taxpayers there. Are you sort of interested in being part of that conversation, or are you happy to sort of have an influence on that, but it doesn't really preoccupy you?
I'm extremely interested in it. I devote my life to making art accessible to a very broad range of people.
What is the state of that discourse then? I mean, you know, I'm talking in gross sort of oversimplifications then. Is it in a good place? Do you know, we have the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square and all the rest of it. Are people a bit better informed? Are they engaged enough?
I think there's a fantastically healthy engagement in art. I mean, of course, not everybody is or will be, but I think that the barriers that were really evident around something like the Rachel Whiteread House, which divided people, really doesn't exist to anything like the same degree. I think Anthony Gormley's had a lot to do with that. He has just allowed something to become part of people's vocabulary and part of people's experience. The Angel of the North, like it or not, and I do, works. It works really well, both as something which is a kind of standard bearer for Gateshead and mostly Gateshead and Newcastle. But also, if you get out of your car and you walk to the base of that sculpture, you will always have a conversation with somebody. And similarly, his work on Crosby Beach, which happens to be where I grew up, north of Liverpool. I knew that beach as a kid. Nobody went there. And now it's a place. Now it's become a place that people really enjoy. Mm. And they enjoy the sculpture. And very definitely, there's a familiarity with contemporary sculpture, which I would say certainly didn't exist 10, 20 years ago.
Is that the genius of the pieces? You know, obviously, if they're site-specific, there's something, that's a calculation that the artist has to make. Or is it also sort of symptomatic of a broader engagement with contemporary art from that people have, do you think?
I think it's symptomatic of a broader engagement. And I think, you know, what we see in the world around us, in our culture, is people seeking experiences which are unique to them. You know, you see the way that people tattoo their bodies, the clothes they wear, the food that they choose to eat, the cinemas that they want to go to, the films they want to see, the books they want to read. And so, you know, there is a great freedom in, I think, an increasing freedom in the way that people absorb the world around them. And there are less definitions between I like this or I don't like that. I mean, I find it extraordinary if anyone says to me, I mean, nobody would say I don't like science. You know, you just wouldn't say it. And I think that notion of people saying I don't like art is less and less and less as time goes on. I think free sculpture has done something quite particular, and that's the beauty and the power of being able to collect a body of work within a very particular environment. It's a beautiful environment to begin with. So you really do have a sense of going to an exhibition rather than something which is just kind of dotted about. At least that's, I hope. I mean, I think I'm pretty good at citing sculpture. So I hope that the kind of the hand that I play in this is, if not visible to people, is something that people are kind of unconsciously absorbing.
I wondered also if, like, you know, the kind of institutions like the Tate Modern opened in the early noughties, wasn't it? Mm. And it's not that long ago that there would be these, like, terribly irate Daily Mail articles about the Turner Prize and what a scandal. And no one does get that excited about these things anymore, do they? It's like normal. It's part of it's part of the kind of the cultural landscape and the diet of culture that's...
Well, and look at the visitor numbers to Tate, to the Whitechapel, to the Serpentine, to Baltic, to Manchester Art Gallery, Yorkshire Sculpture Park. We have 500,000 visitors a year.
That's not bad.
It's not bad.
Not 6 million in Regent's Park.
Well, hey.
Now, Claire, impossible question time. And I know this is like asking people to sort of choose their favourite child. So it's a slightly unfair question, but... Pick us maybe one thing that visitors to the Free Sculpture 2018 really can't afford to miss. And maybe it's something where there is a serendipitous thing that happens once it's actually there that renders it even more beautiful and wondrous than you had dreamt. Is there sort of one thing that really embodies what this is all about that you could direct potential visitors to go and see, perhaps?
That is a really horrible question.
I did flag it as horrible, but...
Oh, wow.
You can have a couple if you want to. Or you could have, you know, the moment when you turn from this one to this one or something.
Well, let me just kind of pull out a couple. That we've got an amazing piece by Conrad Shawcross, which is a kind of collection of poles around which are shaped punctured steel. And it sounds quite brutal. And in a sense, from a distance it is. But as the sun catches it, and it's very deliberately on an east-west axis, it shimmers and changes, and it has, and really it's kind of playing on those notions of capturing the power of the sun that you see in Neolithic monuments. And it's also a labyrinth. So you can walk within it, you can walk through it, you can play in it. So it's a really beautiful work that kind of touches all sorts of important ideas about sculpture, but also about participation and the enjoyment of sculpture. Another, which I'm absolutely thrilled to have, is a work by Kim Soo-ja, who is a South Korean artist, and it's called A Needlewoman. And Kim Soo-ja's name, Soo-ja, means needlewoman. It's the name her mother gave her. And the notion of stitching and nurture has been an important part of her practice. And she created a work which began in 1999, where she filmed herself, just the back of her body, absolutely still in the kind of maelstrom of a city like Shanghai or New York. So this is the work. And the piece that we have is a 13-metre high spike, I suppose you would call it, a needle. It's just an incredibly beautiful work. She developed it with scientists at Cornell University, and the acrylic panes of the work have a polymer coating, which is the closest that you can get to the iridescence of an insect's wings. And so it's a really beautiful work that sort of shimmers, particularly in this light. And one, I'm very proud that we have it in Free Sculpture. And it's also a work that, of course, kind of heralds the exhibition from kind of all points of the compass.
It sounds almost poetic just describing it. Imagine when you're actually there with it in front of you. Claire, it's an absolute delight to have you with us. And people can see the pieces right through till 7th of October, is that correct?
Yes.
Do we need to direct them where they can find out more? Is that presumably
There's an app with me talking. And if they go to the Free's website, there's plenty of information there.
Wonderful. And I'm sure you've piqued interest sufficiently that listeners, both local and more far-flung to Monocle 24, will say, what about Yorkshire Sculpture Park? Where can I find out more about that as well?
Go to our website.
There you go. Claire Lilly, curator for Free's Sculpture, director of Yorkshire Sculpture Park. Thanks very much for coming to see us.
Thank you.
80s music, Tom. How do you feel about it?
I am an enthusiast, to say the least. Or don't tell me we're playing an 80s classic right now.
We are indeed. Not only are we playing an 80s classic, we're playing an 80s classic that one of our guests played on himself.
Ah, I see where you're going with this. Marcus Miller.
Marcus
Miller.
He's
coming up in just a moment.
That's it.
What have you got?
The man, the legend. From 1981, we have Never Too Much by Luther Vandross.
Yeah.
Grammy-winning bassist and bandleader Marcus Miller's work can be heard on hits ranging from Never Too Much by Luther Vandross, which you just heard, of course, to Bill Withers' Just the Two of Us. He also has the distinction of being one of the few musicians trusted to take care of the low end in the band of none other than jazz great Miles Davis.
Now he's back with a new album, Laid Black, and will soon be playing a couple of nights at London's historic Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club. Earlier, he spoke to Monocle's Tom Hall about his new record and the music career that shaped it.
Well, the previous one was called Aphrodisia, and because I do work with UNESCO, you're familiar with UNESCO?
Yeah.
Because I do work with UNESCO, the spokesperson for a project they have called the Slave Root Project, where we try to raise awareness of the history of slavery, I decided to use the Aphrodisia album to kind of reinforce that. So I followed the root of my ancestors, right, with musical collaboration. So I played with some West Africans, some North Africans, some folks from the Caribbean, some musicians from South America, and musicians from the southern part of the USA. So it's kind of like following the history. The music wasn't, you know, old sounding, but I used elements from each of those places. For this album, I decided I'm going to bring it all the way up to now. I'm going to finish the story, at least for now. And so on this album, you hear contemporary elements. You know, you hear, like you were mentioning, you'll hear elements from hip hop, from trap music, specifically soul, funk, you know what I mean? It's kind of the continuation of the story, but this one's a little bit more lighthearted and fun. When you listen to it, you can really just have a good time without really worrying about what this is all about. Well, you know, my touring band is a bunch of incredibly talented young musicians. Anybody who's seen us at the London Jazz Festival, they've witnessed this band. You know, these guys are monsters. Alex Hahn is our saxophonist, and Marquise Hill plays the trumpet. Alex Bailey is the drummer, and Brett Williams plays the keyboard. So that's my core band, and that's the band I went in the studio with and recorded the basic tracks for this album.
The list of the people that you've collaborated with is just immense and slightly ridiculous. I was looking on kind of All Music and just looking at all the credits, and I might try and duck into some of the stranger ones. And
okay,
because some of them are so unusual that I right. just thought maybe it's another Marcus
maybe
Miller.
It's another maybe, dude. Yeah,
but let's talk about some of the big hitters. I mean, you worked for years with Miles Davis, which is absolutely, that's no small fry, is it? Tell me a little bit about working with him and what kind of person was he?
Well, by the time I started working with him, which is like the 80s, right, he was already a legend and had been a legend for years and years and years. It was really interesting to just be around him and see how does a legend walk, how does a legend talk, what kind of food does a legend eat, you know what I mean? And none of that was remarkable. He's just a human being. And it was good for me, it's good for all of us to meet some legends and see that they don't walk on air and they have to process life the same way all of us do. So that was a big lesson. The thing he was courageous. And you think, okay, how courageous do you have to be a musician? You know, but if you think in the 1950s, he was the biggest jazz star in the world, you know. When Frank Sinatra was finished with his gig or Ava Gardner was finished with her movie, they would go down to hear Miles. You know, he was that dude, you know. And at the end of the 50s, even though he was hugely successful, he said, yeah, it's time to stop. I'm going to do something different. And how do you throw away that kind of success? Because you don't know if the next thing you do is going to be successful or not. But Miles didn't care. He did it. He ended up with another band in the 60s that was really, really popular. Beginning of the 70s, he does the same thing again. He just said, okay, you know, I'm going to make another move, you know. And he did this maybe 3 or 4 times, which is incredible. When I began to work with him as a composer and a bass player, I wrote some music for him that was, again, very different from what he had been doing before. And the thing is, if you make great music in an era and then you change it, you piss a lot of people off. You know what I mean? Because they fell in love with what you were doing. Maybe they met their first girlfriend with your music, you know, and all of a sudden you abandon that style. They feel like you're abandoning them. And there's things about that music they love and might be things about your new style that they don't like. So you're always pissing people off, you know what I mean? And even in the 80s, I did an album with Miles called Tutu. And there were young people who heard it who just loved it. And there's older fans of Miles go, oh, this is horrible, you know what I mean? And, you know, when I saw those reactions, I was really happy because that meant I'm continuing the tradition of Miles of pissing people off, you know what I mean?
And brave choices.
And brave choices, yeah, exactly. So he was very courageous in that respect, and I got to witness that firsthand.
Another musician that you've worked with, I mean, obviously this will be very familiar territory to talk about to you. I'm sure you've talked about it many times, but mm-hmm. I think that listeners just might not be aware of some of the amazing tracks that you've contributed to. And another artist, Luther Vandross, Never Too Much, that is an enormous song. Everybody knows it. Can you just briefly talk me through a little bit of how that song came together and what you brought to that?
Luther and I were both in Roberta Flack's band, and Roberta Flack is an amazing singer, and she was really popular in the 70s. She had a song called First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, which was number one in every country in the world in 1971. She was massive. Luther was singing background with her, like 1979, and I was playing bass in the band. So we became buddies, you know, we became mates, and he was like, you know what, I want to make my own album, I want to make my own music. And I was like, man, you're the number one background singer in New York. You're making a lot of money. He's singing on TV commercials for McDonald's and Ford trucks. That was our thing in New York as studio musicians.
Yeah.
We did commercials in the morning. And it was really lucrative. I said, why would you want the headache of being an artist when you can just do your thing? He said, no, I got a lot of music inside me that I want to do. I'm going to do a demo. And the only studio time I could get, Marcus, was on Sunday morning. Can you make it? I said, oh, this is crazy, but of course, you're my guy. Okay, I'm going to do it. So it was Luther's piano playing accompanist. His name was Nat Adderley Jr. He was the nephew of the great Cannonball Adderley. And, you know, Buddy Williams on drums. And he and Nat had written the song, Never Too Much. And they gave me the notes. My job was, how do I play the notes? You know, do I play it soft? Do I play it aggressive? So, of course, I choose aggressive, you know, because I'm from New York. And boom, boom, doom, doom, boom, doom, 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 boom, 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 doom. And on the I plucked it really hard, you know what I mean? Because, you know, that's how we did in New York. You had to get people's attention. So anyway, it was a nice demo. You know, Luther walked from record company to record company for a year trying to get a deal, trying to get somebody to sign him. And at that time, we're talking 79, 80.
He walked around with that song and couldn't
four,
get a deal.
Four songs, including that song.
That's amazing, isn't it?
He couldn't get a deal because at that time, it was Earth, Wind & Fire. It was Cameo. It was Lakeside. These are the R&B groups that were happening. It was big groups with 12 dudes in the group, you know, with all sorts of colors on stage, you know? And they said, what's your thing? What's your gimmick, Luther? He says, my gimmick is that I sing really good. You know what I mean? And for some of these record companies, that wasn't enough. After a year, he finally got a deal from a guy named Larkin Arnold at Epic Records. And they put it out. Now, the record company execs couldn't hear it, but the rest of the world flipped when they heard that record, that Never Too Much record. And then all of a sudden, overnight, you would hear it all day long on the radio. You know, like you say, it was just enormous. And it was like the first time that I saw something from the ground floor, meaning Luther was just a background singer, and I literally saw him in front of my eyes become one of the hugest stars in the world. And a lot of it was because of that first song, Never Too Much.
Do you ever find yourself, and this is not in not applying to that session, because mm-hmm. you've clearly explained how that happened, but do you ever find yourself as a musician maybe contributing something where it's really the foundation? It could be the founding lick of the song, but it's another artist's album and it's their name on the cover. How do you sort of walk out of those sessions? Do you walk away just being like, that's my song, not their song?
Well, I've never walked away from the session, but I've heard the song on the radio when I realized, hey, man, that thing's kind of centered around the bass. You know? I said, ah, man, next time I need to have a conversation with them. Of course, it never happens again with that artist, you know what I mean, where you can actually say, last time, maybe I should have got some writer's credit. You know, you just keep going through the same situation with different artists. But that was kind of like the life of a studio musician. We accepted that back then. Things are different now, and people are thinking differently, especially because a lot of the studio musicians I work with, the studio musician scene disappeared when you could start making music with computers. So now these guys aren't working as much, and I'm sure there's a lot of second thoughts about, man, I should have got some writer's credit on that song or this song.
And then finally, I want to have a bit of fun here, and you can correct me on this, because I was looking through the things you've done, and it's vast.
Some of it might not be me.
Indeed. Well, this right. is this. Okay. You can correct us. Some of them I'm pretty sure you've had a pretty big hand in. One of the things that actually surprised me was Jay-Z in Reasonable Doubt, and the only reason it surprised me is because I always think of hip-hop being so based in samples that I just wonder how much live musicians would contribute. But tell me a little bit of what you did there.
I had an album in 1982 that Jay-Z sampled.
Exactly. Well, there right. you go. It's
so
interesting.
So it's exactly what you would think. But the bass is so prominent on it, you know what I mean, that people will cite me as having played the bass on it. Yeah.
That's interesting. There is a credit on All Music that says Blue Man Group Art Direction. That's not you, is it?
Not me.
No, that's interesting. Brian Ferry.
I absolutely played on Brian Ferry albums and still do it, matter of fact. His last two albums, I played on a lot of songs. The first album I played on for Brian was Boys and Girls, which was a really big album for him. And then I played on one called Bête Noire, which was, I think, the follow-up to that. But we're good buddies, and I really dig playing with him.
1984, Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, Quincy Jones was a conductor. Phil Ramone, legendary producer, was the engineer. Quincy convinced Phil to stop producing and just be an engineer, go back to his old days. And we had a room full of musicians that included George Benson, Brecker Brothers, and Lionel Hampton, who's a legendary jazz vibraphone player, and Frank Sinatra. Yeah, the album's called L.A. Is My Lady. It's a great experience.
2002, The Baha Men?
The Baha Men. I think that's a sample again.
Okay, that's interesting. They're the ones who did like Who Let the Dogs Out, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's a sample. I didn't hang with those guys.
Okay, and Elton John.
One of my first early recordings, first time flying to Europe to do a recording session, I was probably 19, and Elton was doing a record produced by a guy named Pete Bellotti, who was co-producer for Donna Summer, and I played on that, so that's true.
What was Elton wearing? He was pretty partial to some outfits.
Man, I don't remember, but he was a little low-key at the time. He was a little low-key. But it was a record called Victim of Love, and Elton was trying to get into some dance music, you know? And so it's not one of his most memorable records, but it's a great experience for me.
Marcus Miller there speaking to Tom Hall, and his album Laid Black is out now. Catch him at Ronnie Scott's in London on the 10th and 12th of July. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Oliver Wainwright is architecture and design critic for The Guardian, and his hunger for finding less exposed classics recently led him to the hermit state of North Korea.
His new book for Tashin is Inside North Korea, and earlier he joined Tom to talk about it.
I should probably say it came about a bit by accident, because I went to North Korea without having a book in mind. I essentially went on a package tour. There's a company called Corio based in Beijing, and it was the first time they'd organised a specific architectural tour, so I kind of signed up straight away, having heard about that. And to be honest, these are kind of my holiday snaps. There wasn't enough time on the trip to, you know, use a tripod and kind of very carefully stage manage these shots. So it's kind of, you know, all shot handheld, shot based on what I saw. And then the book really came as a byproduct of that. Mm. When I got back to London, I set up a Tumblr account called North Korean Interiors. And that seemed to kind of capture a lot of people's imagination just because of the slightly surreal quality of a lot of these spaces.
Oh, I'd have to say, you would never guess that they weren't the full tripod bells and whistles
from the finished
product. And what do you think it is? Is it that the idea that obviously captures people's imagination so immediately, is it the fact that this is still, even though we know a little more, it's the unseen, it's the other side. There's so much mystery. Is that
Is that where the power lies, or is it in, as a sort of architectural purist, is it in the scale, you know, the sort of majesty of some of these things?
I think it's a combination of the two. I mean, like you say, you know, I went to North Korea with very preconceived notions of this, you know, monumental city of kind of endless, anonymous, marching concrete blocks, gargantuan boulevards populated by tanks toting ceremonial missiles, you know, all the stuff that we see in the Western media. And I was just really surprised at the novelty and the originality of a lot of the architecture. Mm. I suppose the first thing that struck me was the sheer amount of colour all over the city. You know, they do have a lot of fairly generic concrete apartment buildings.
A lot of floral notes, aren't there?
Yeah, they're all painted in these pastel, you know, candy colours. You have kind of baby blue, terracotta, yellow ochre, pink. It's one of the most colourful cities I've been to. And when you see the panorama from the top of the Juche Tower, which is the central monument in Pyongyang, it does look like someone's emptied this kind of packet of fruit pastels across the city. I think the colour was the most striking thing. And then the interiors, a lot of them have this very specific kind of symmetrical arrangement to direct your view to the portraits of the leaders, which are always hanging at the end of the far wall.
And this was, of course, an explicit sort of requirement that that image was very much, well,
exactly,
quite literally centred.
Yeah, they have a regulation that one wall in every public room has to be devoted to the leaders, and nothing else is allowed to be hung on that wall. So you have the two portraits of Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il, always smiling. That's another thing that's fascinating about the depiction of the Kim regime, you know, unlike a lot of other kind of strongmen dictators who are always posing, looking furious into the middle distance. They're always offering a cheery grin and these kind of rosy cheeks and a bright white smile. There's something very kind of joyous about the colour palettes and the floral decoration and the general aesthetic of Pyongyang that I wasn't expecting at all.
Well, absolutely. And I've sort of opened book. This was, and I guess in a sense, this maybe was more one of the images you might have been expecting, the sort of 20-metre bronze statues and all the rest. But the Kims, you know, again, in a sort of anorak, but very, really jovial. Yeah. And I wondered whether, I guess like a lot of sort of Soviet-era monumental sculpture and the rest, is there a bit of a chill around it? Is there something that kind of rings hollow? Because as you said, it's very jovial and fun, but we know this is a country absolutely sort of, you know, it's hugely divided, there's massive poverty and all the rest of it. Is there something that sort of rings hollow, or do they do a good job at selling the Kim dream?
Yeah,
like?
I mean, there's no doubt about the motives of this monumental architecture. And the, you know, if you read Kim Jong-il's manifesto, he wrote a fascinating treatise in 1991 called On Architecture, which is a must for any North Korean architecture enthusiast. And he's very explicit about these architectural devices, saying that either side of the central monument we've designed the apartment buildings to look like a great crowd of the cheering masses looking up towards the leader. And he explicitly says the leader's statue must be placed in the centre of every architectural space. This is all about making the individual feel very insignificant in comparison to the omnipresence of the leaders. So, I mean, yeah, there's definitely an eerie, slightly sinister facet to the theatre of Pyongyang.
And talking of eerie, there's some amazing shots of the sort of the highway, the reunification highway, is it, that essentially isn't used much, if at all.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, I understand you were sort of chaperoned around always. Mm. Were there ever any, and that's obviously very carefully stage managed, as you one might imagine.
Yeah.
Did you ever sort of train your camera or your gaze at anything and note a change in the demeanour? And when did that happen? Because, you know, there's something quite eerie about those highway shots. And I wondered whether there was ever any, Why are you taking a picture of that type?
No, it was interesting. To be honest, the freedom was much greater than I was expecting. I kind of assumed you'd be on and off a minibus. They'd say, this is your Kodak moment. You know, point your camera here, take your shot, then back on the bus.
There's nothing to see behind me.
Exactly, yeah. To be honest, as long as you stayed within eyesight of the guides, you know, you can kind of wander down the street. Obviously, you weren't allowed to walk around the city on your own or leave the hotel on your own once we got back for the day. But we could take photos of most things. There were three very specific rules about photography. One was nothing under construction, which I thought was fascinating because they want everything to look finished and perfect. And obviously, being an architecture critic, that was very frustrating because we passed these fascinating building sites of, you know, monumental towers being poured in concrete very sloppily. You know, often the walls didn't seem to line up with the floors below, and we couldn't take pictures of those. The other rule was about no military installations, which, again, is a fairly common rule in most countries in the world. Don't photograph security. And finally, people. They said if you're going to take someone's photo, make sure they're worn so they're kind of looking their best. You know, they weren't really that keen on kind of candid street photography. So, I mean, yeah, there are the occasional shots you could snap out of the window of the bus at something maybe less showcase-like. You know, as you say, when we left Pyongyang and went along the reunification highway, we did pass, you know, much more kind of crumbling concrete apartment blocks, kids in very ragged clothes playing in the streets, these kind of rusting electricity pylons. So it very quickly became apparent that Pyongyang is the bubble, it's the showcase city, and then as soon as you leave, the general standard of living drops dramatically in the rest of the country.
And what about that idea of the people? I mean, I know you have spoken, and I think you sort of reflect in the book on the fact that, you know, you can't get the anecdotal side of things because it's all too sort of stage managed. But in the section on leisure, I mean, there's some incredible pictures in particular of the stadium, which was all refurbed, built in the late 90s, I think. And I love that optimistically include both FIFA and Olympic logos, just in case.
One day they might host the Olympic Games.
But there's
a
lot about leisure and sport. And again, we've seen a lot of these regimes. There's a great emphasis on that. And there's pictures of, there's some really sweet pictures of kids having fun.
Yeah, rollerblading around
was it
the car
all,
park.
Was that all for your benefit? Did you see any sort of fissures in that? Or was it? Did it seem like people were actually, even admittedly only in Pyongyang, having fun?
Yeah, no, I think they were. I think the most surprising thing was we went to a water park on a Saturday afternoon and we all went very cynically thinking, oh yeah, this is just something they've built to show off to Western tourists. And it was heaving with local families. I mean, there was no way of telling if this was only the elite, but to be honest, it looked like a fairly mixed crowd. You know, lots of school groups going down the water slides, lots of families, even grandparents hanging out on the artificial beach next to the waxwork figure of Kim Jong-il. And there did seem to be genuine kind of joy at this new facility. And I think Kim Jong-un has been very clever, actually, in providing just the right amount of leisure facilities for the kind of emerging middle class. So he's built a ski resort recently outside the capital. There's a new horse riding centre, several kind of theme parks and water parks in the capital. And I think it's very similar to if you follow the logic of Chinese communism. You know, they know just enough like what to give people to prevent a mass revolution from happening. You know, so if there are enough distractions and just the right amount of leisure, then he can keep people subdued. And it's interesting, there is, I mean, obviously this is my one and only trip to Pyongyang, but speaking to the guides, there was one Western guide with us, you know, going back, he said, actually, there is this emerging middle class with spending power, that there's a kind of tacitly allowed market economy. People, you know, informally trade, they swap apartments, they're now allowed to buy cars for the first time. We passed a coffee shop where the waitresses seemingly had these kind of tablet menus. You know, so there is a kind of emerging level of the consumer economy, and I think the leisure industry is a big part of that.
Now, I don't know how this would work, but have you had or do you anticipate any sort of feedback, whether that's from Pyongyang? Obviously, they've got their slightly surreal embassy in, I think it's in Cricklewood, isn't it? They're too far away from
here. Yeah, exactly, in a semi-detached house.
It's bizarre. Do you anticipate that, or have there been any? Does anything filter through?
There hasn't been anything.
Would you be intrigued?
I would be very interested. Yeah, I mean, I would love to send a copy to our guys. We had three official guides with us at all times. And again, you would imagine these kind of robotic people who just read off their official script, but they were very normal, nice, funny people, you know, great sense of humour, and I would love to somehow get a copy of the book to them. I mean, as it stands, there's no, physically no way of being able to communicate with them. So yeah, I'm still awaiting feedback. And
we'll see how that one goes.
Finding out if I'll be allowed to return. You know, I'd love to go back.
Well, this is it, and that's interesting. I was going to say it's quite a sort of warm portrait, and that may not be a phrase you'd welcome. Did you like what you saw? I mean, even if we talk about it in sort of theoretically, architecturally, could you enjoy what you were seeing?
On a certain level, I could. I mean, I think I was just fascinated constantly by everything I saw, particularly by the originality of some of the buildings from the late 1980s. So, I mean, if you can subtract the kind of political motivation behind a lot of these projects, which, to be honest, is the same in so many cities around the world, so many different kinds of regime. They hosted an event in 1989 called the World Festival of Youth and Students, which is a kind of communist Olympic Games. And that was treated as the deadline to complete a whole load of trophy projects all around the city. So there's a very futuristic-looking ice rink that was built for that those games that looks like a kind of white concrete teepee. And then there's a whole campus district called Chongchun Sports Street where the weightlifting arena is designed like a pair of dumbbells and the badminton stadium has a roof that follows the arc of a shuttlecock. You know, so there are actually some quite interesting... It's postmodernism, you know, of its own particular brand. And I think, yeah, I don't know whether like is the right word, but I was definitely fascinated by it.
Struck by
it. Yeah, awestruck. Yeah. And I think it is an under, for obvious reasons, it's an underexposed centre of architecture. You know, not many of these buildings are known. And they're fascinating. You know, there are so many. So the earlier period, immediately after the Korean War, you have these buildings that at first glance look very Stalinist. They're kind of neoclassical, puffed up, you know, inflated wedding cake buildings. But if you look more closely, the detailing is very explicitly Korean. And that was something that Kim Il-sung was determined to enforce, that, you know, yeah, we can copy outside forms, but we should inflect them with a distinctly nationalist flavour. And so rather than having regular cylindrical classical columns, they have octagonal columns, which is a reference to the ancient Korean temples. Mm. And they have these overhanging giwa green tiled rooftops. So I think for every period, you know, there's just such a fascinating story behind all of these buildings that, yeah, I was just compelled by everything.
And you mentioned sort of Sports Street and you have the sort of science district. And again, like in a lot of these regimes, there's this fascination with the cutting edge and innovation and the power of science. Were you sold, admittedly, only it's one visit, it's hard to make these big extrapolations, but were you sold on the whether that was genuine or not? You know, even if we look at, say, the practice of architecture, I mean, is there a North Korean architecture? I mean, there's elements of a vernacular, I suppose.
I think there definitely is. And it's a fascinating pick and mix collage. We had a really interesting visit to the Paektusan Academy, which is the kind of central state architecture bureau where most of these trophy projects are designed. And we got to see their gallery of precedent projects. So it was a kind of international showcase of buildings that they're encouraged to reference or to draw inspiration from. And it was everything from the Great Pyramids at Giza to Terry Farrell's MI6 headquarters on the banks of the Thames in Vauxhall to Japanese metabolist structures. And they all shared this very common thread. They were very formally expressive and very kind of daring and monolithic. And it's interesting that that does filter through into most of the buildings they're making. They all have that monumentality to them.
And could that travel? I mean, I don't know. It would be interesting, wouldn't it? I mean, is there a... I don't know. Or, you know, even if you look across, say, the whole of the Korean peninsula, does it feel like a peninsula that could be... I don't know. Even if you look at sort of potential reunification down the line, is there a coherence about any kind of stylistic elements?
It's very different to South Korea. And I think if people from Seoul visited Pyongyang, they'll be pleasantly surprised because compared to the sprawling metropolis of Seoul, Pyongyang retains its kind of garden-like quality. Yeah. When it was first laid out in the 1950s after the war, you know, when it was totally destroyed, Kim Il-sung said he wanted it to be a great garden of architecture. And they passed a regulation that only 25% of the land area could be devoted to buildings. And the rest is parkland, you know, riverside promenades. And it's got an interesting undulating topography. It's set between two hills and then two rivers wind their way through. So it is actually quite a pleasant, you know, campus-like garden city, surprisingly. I mean, partly because it's been incubated from the usual forces of foreign investment, which would lead to endless sprawling tower blocks like we see in Seoul. So no, it's very different to South Korea. The one similarity, perhaps, not necessarily in architecture, but in visual culture, is the colour palette. Mm. So these pastel colours, particularly the pinks and this kind of celadon porcelain minty green, you know, that's common throughout the Korean peninsula because they both draw on those kind of ancient colour schemes.
Oliver Wainwright there, speaking to Tom Edwards earlier, and his book, Inside North Korea, is out now from Taschen. You're with the Monocle Weekly.
Well, another Monocle Weekly bites the dust. Org, I must say, a pleasure. Our first time in the chairs together. Great stuff.
Inaugural. Deeply enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Now, I know you're a man that appreciates contemporary art, sculpture, etc. Great to hear from Claire earlier. Are you going to be striking out immediately to Regent's Park to check out some of those extraordinary sculptural installations?
I'm going up there on my bike with my sandwiches for lunch, Can't wait. Barty
don't,
Kerr.
Don't ride on the paths in the park or you'll fall foul of the authorities, of course.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll take the circuitous route.
I'm watching out for you. And that's all for edition 470 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall and researched by Julia Webster and Paula Schulze. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. My thanks to them all. This programme will be back at the same time next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.
And from me, Augusta Macellari.
That's all. Thanks for listening.